Have you ever considered that there may be more than one species of moose in Alaska, or that people actually lived here before moose did? Well, February's talk with Kevin Colson of Alaska Department of Fish and Game covers that topic. Coming to America, a moose story. Moose are common in large parts of Alaska and Canada, but it hasn't always been that way. Join Kevin as he talks about how we've gradually uncovered the story of how moose populated the state. He'll talk about how extinct moose and the Ice Age, Canadian logging, relocation, and blind luck have led to where moose are now and what the future may hold for them. Let's join Kevin now.
Excellent. Well, as she said, I'm Kevin, and I work for Alaska Department of Fish and Game. You can tell because we have our nice big logo on the bottom of this very professional-looking opening slide, but it wasn't my first choice. With a title like Coming to America, I thought, well, how many of you remember Eddie Murphy's finest comedic hour? Look out, Paramount. We're on your tail. So, this is a pretty full room here. I don't think I need to explain to you why people care about moose, but for those of you who are here for extra credit, let's just get down to brass tacks. For the state of Alaska alone, the meat value that's hunted year in year is estimated at around $37.5 million. That's just the meat value. Never mind the money that goes into our economy with people coming up from the states to go hunt. Moose are the fifth most sought-after land animal for tourists. They want to see a moose. They want to see a moose more than want to see a wolf. And the viewing value is around $3.8 million. Now, most of that goes to places around Denali National Park, where you can go in the fall during the rut and see a lot of moose along the roads. It's a big photography opportunity that people take advantage of. On top of that, moose are important to us Alaskans culturally. We feel connected to them, be it the person who talks about moose camp, you know, 364 days a year and just can't wait to get back out there, to the local natives who this has been part of their foodstuff for generations, the subsistence is built into their culture. And on top of that, you have a more nebulous thing called existence value, and that's the value that someone, say, down in New Mexico would place on a moose out there. They will never see that moose. They'll never eat that moose. They'll never go hunt it. But they like the idea that somewhere out there, there's a 1,000-pound animal roaming around someone's neighborhood snarling up traffic. And that's not to miss the most important reason, which is moose are perhaps the most dignified animal in Alaska. Very majestic, very majestic. So throughout this talk, you're probably going to be scratching your head going, why on earth is a fish and game person looking at all these different, like, Ice Age questions and the deep history of moose? And it all boils down to fish and game's role as stewards of populations. This is a hypothetical. Say in the year 2151, we fly around with our laser drones or whatever we're using then, and we see in the Tananaw Flats just south of Fairbanks that the population seems to be declining. But when we go to the Antarctic Control Use Area, we're counting more moose. What does that mean? Did the moose from the four lands here move on down into the Antarctic Control Use Area? Or is it something about births and deaths that's causing an imbalance in a different area? What it boils down to is the question of, what is your population? Now, for biologists, when we talk about populations, the general definition we're rolling with is a group of interbreeding individuals. So they at least need the potential to mate together and create new offspring. This means it's a demographically cohesive unit, a unit that's driven by reproduction and death more than it is immigrants and emigrants, so individuals coming to and leaving the area. Determining this is a very foxy problem, but one of my preferred methods involves looking at genetics. Just like you're related to your family, on a certain level, populations have fingerprints in their genetics that show that they are, in fact, a cohesive demographic units. It's not as simple as looking at relatedness, although relatedness does factor in some populations. More often than not, it's really subtle statistical things, but if you understand that being a population leaves its fingerprints in your genetics, then you're 90% of the way there. And just like you can use genetics to reconstruct a family tree, with populations, you can look at a family tree of family trees. Use the genetics to retrace how populations break apart and rejoin, over time exchanging migrants and individuals who breed and or don't breed. This is very useful for managers because oftentimes we don't have 100 plus years of data, and the genetics is recording the history that's been going on over a long time. So it's pretty darn useful. And in the process, it helps us recreate the ancestral condition of these moose. Just like looking at the like family tree and seeing so-and-so as the grandparent, we could look at this population split off into this area, and this population split off into this area. And what it tells us is a really fascinating story. But to begin that story, we're going to have to go back, way back to the Ice Age. The world looked very different during the Ice Age. As the name implies, there was a lot of ice in the Ice Age. Fancy that. Most of it was locked up in big North American and Eurasian ice sheets there. And Greenland, which is still pretty icy today, was even more icy, if you can believe it. Because there was so much water locked up in ice, the sea level was considerably lower than it was, and it created a land bridge between Russia, the Russian Far East, and Alaska. We call this area Beringia. We were located in eastern Beringia. So eastern Beringia is in the west, and western Beringia is in the Russian Far East. I don't make up these terms. In particular, we would be here, so we would be under about a mile of ice. No one opened the door. It'd be a little drafty. It was a lot different. And like the physical geography was different, the composition of the animals was also very different. Imagine for a moment looking outside and having a herd of mastodons wandering around doing mastodon-related things. It was wild. On top of mastodons, we had short-faced bears, an extinct species of bear, almost the size of a vehicle, if not a little larger, which is an ambush predator. Scares the heck out of me. We had a variety of antelope species in Alaska. And then we had some species that we're familiar with, but you go outside, you don't see very many elk. We have elk in Alaska, but only because we brought them back. And then we had horses. And there were so many horses that when I was sorting through the Pleistocene collection of bones at the University of Alaska Museum, 9 out of 10 bones I handled was either a horse or a woods bison, the other major constituent of this Beringian mammal community. Woods bison just recently came back thanks to the help of Alaska Department of Fish and Game and a number of other partners, and we got high hopes for wood bison in the future. And of course, you have the random doll sheep standing at ground level with a bunch of predators and a few horses. This is clearly in our not sure it quite worked like that. So I haven't mentioned moose once in that laundry list of species that are around here. This is stuff we found from digging in the ground and looking at the bones. What do we find in the bones? Where were the moose? And in order to discuss that, we first need to talk about what on earth is a moose? Well, a moose is a deer. But there was more than one moose. Let's start off with, we have Cervalces scotti, the stag moose. Now these common names, they're kind of squishy, so some people will call it the stag moose, other people will call it all sorts of other things. Cervalces scotti is generally how scientists talk about it, and since they're extinct, it's mostly scientists talking about it. You look at those antlers and those are wild. It looks like a thicket growing out of the main beam. We generally found these though, south of the North American ice sheets. So down in the Ohio, part of Michigan, out to Iowa, they probably used a lot of ponds, but they probably also used a lot of grassland, which is a little different from what modern moose do. Moose don't deal well with grasslands. There was also another species that was kicking around then, Cervalces latifrons, the broad-fronted moose. Now this guy, I mean, yeah, that is something else. The antlers came out in a very long beam and did what I very scientifically call jazz hands at the end. And they were not small antlers either. Here's a line drawing of modern moose antlers, and this would be a set of Cervalces latifrons antlers. They were big animals. They lived out in the open tundra in the, nearly called it Soviet, Russian Far East, and some places around here. They're also in Eurasia, as were stag moose. Stag moose were also in Europe, but I'm gonna ignore Europe for most of this talk. Were they in Alaska? We haven't found much, but we've at least found one, and a very interesting one at that. In 1940s, around Little El Dorado Creek, they dug up a moose mummy. And not only do we know it was Cervalces latifrons from the bones, we know it was a male because it had a little spike, and we knew how old it was and when it died because it still had that spike and it was fully grown, it wasn't in velvet or anything. Really fascinating. But nowhere in all the bones we've handled have we found what we think of as modern moose. Now, to go back, some old hypotheses, Randolph Peterson, excuse me, was the first person to take a crack at where moose were and how they came to be in North America. And he had an idea that moose were in Alaska, and they also were in the mountain Intermountain West, a little bit in where you have Illinois, and then a group on the eastern seaboard. Now, since then, we've got pretty clever about figuring out how the landscape looked back in the Ice Age. And that's through going to these ponds and taking pond scum, basically, the bottom of these ponds, and looking at the pollens and trying to reconstruct over time what the pollen record showed in terms of plant communities. And what we find is that Alaska probably didn't have a heck of a lot of what we think of as good modern moose habitat. It had a polar desert, which is a lot like modern Ellesmere Island. It had some tundra, which is marginal moose habitat. It's not the best. Down in the lower 48, where they thought there was going to be one refugia of moose, there was grassland. That's definitely not moose habitat. It's stag moose habitat, apparently, but it's not modern moose habitat. So this got a couple of people thinking, in particular an old mentor of mine, Chris Hundermark. This is him and the moose Tutka. I'll let you figure out which is which. I'm not sure which one looks more like a moose, though. I'm told he's the distinguished moose researcher of the 2000s, was so voted. And I think that's because you can tell him from a distance. He went through and collected genetics from around the world to try to recreate that family tree of family trees we were talking about. And what he found when he mapped them all out is that the most ancestral population, the most grandparenty population, was in an area we call the Magadan Oblast in the Russian Far East and in East Asia. Nowhere near Beringia or Alaska or North America. And certainly we see no indication that there was some unique diversity hanging out in the lower 48 during the last ice age. Now, this group in here then spread out, first spreading down south to China, which actually does have moose, or did anyhow, before they ate them all, and then split into Europe and then headed over to North America, and then proliferated in either. So, now that we know kind of where to look, let's take a look at what the world looked like in that place. Here's the area we're most interested in, and we're going to go ahead and blow it up here and put some labels. Polar desert, we talked about. Ice sheet, I think that one needs no definition, really. And desert, I think you all pretty much know what a desert looks like. Sounds, it's what it is on the tin. Steppe tundra is a habitat that doesn't really exist anymore. Not in the same way it did in the last ice age. And this dry steppe still does exist in areas like Mongolia and then Ukraine, the former Soviet bloc. It's the quintessential horse country, if you will. The open boreal forest, aka where moose likes to be, existed in two patches, one pegged all the way up against the Himalaya Mountains, with nowhere left to retreat. If the climate had changed any further, the habitat would have ceased to be. And another in modern Japan. So, what do we... boxes around it, just so we have boxes, I guess. When we go through and look at the bones that have been found in different places, these are all Cervalces latifrons, most of these throughout here. And there's a couple Cervalces scotti shown on here. So we have some stag moose, but we have a lot of broad-fronted moose. And then what I want to draw your cluster attention to is, you can't see this, but this is a different symbol here. That symbol is for modern moose, and that's pretty darn close to where we suspected we'd find them. Now, Japan has a very active academic culture, and they like archaeology and they like paleontology. They have been digging in Japan for pretty much since post-World War II in modern science. So far, to the best of anyone's knowledge, no one has dug up a moose. So, of our two opportunities, seems like Japan's probably off the list provisionally. So, what does that mean for how they got out of there? Because that's a tiny little fragment. Well, I don't know if you noticed, but the ice age ended. We are not under a mile of ice, and there are not mastodons walking around outside, although that could be pretty cool, I guess. So here's the patch of habitat we're talking about. Again, pressed against the Himalaya Mountains. What's interesting is when we look at the deep genetics of these moose, we found that they went through what we call a bottleneck long ago, where they were really reduced in population. And this might explain the habitat findings and the bone findings really well. And then afterwards, the boreal forest expanded outward as the weather warmed, the ice retreated. And more importantly, in Yakutia and in the Russian Far East, it turned into a habitat we call forest tundra, which it's kind of like it today. Forest tundra can support moose. It's not their favorite place in the world to be, but they can be there at low densities. So that was just in time to get over to North America. The first moose we found in Alaska around 12.5 thousand years ago. And if you look at 12,000 years ago, this is what it looked like. If you go not much further forward in time to 11,000 years ago, the Bering Land Bridge at that point was effectively closed for all intents and purposes. As it was, moose were so late to the game that if they had been a little less lucky, they probably would have not got to North America at all. As it is, my old boss liked to joke that they probably came over and they got their behinds wet. The other thing that's really interesting is that they migrated into areas where there were already humans. Humans had been hunting them as long as humans had been in contact with them. So they then dispersed into areas that had already been humans. Humans had been first found in North America around 13,000 years ago. I haven't looked in a while. That date might have been driven back a little further back by recent finds. But the moral of the story is, when you read the newspaper and you see people, you read the comment section. Big mistake, I know. And what you see someone invariably say, well, the moose were here first. You go, actually, no, people were. Not that it's a good reason to do anything or not do anything, but it's just the people were here first. So almost like we need a little more nuances in the comment sections. So the Beringia closed on up and turned into Russia, the Russian Far East and Alaska, and it's no longer Beringia at that point. Moose kind of were stalled out there for a while, because the ice sheet hadn't really retreated. But gradually, the two major plates in North America came apart and produced an ice-free corridor that at that point, the Alaskan moose could move on down. Probably a group of moose moved a little further on, the population grew. Then a couple of those moose from that population moved a little further out. The population grew there. They probably followed the retreating glacier faces in the what we call the periglacial space, which is right next to glaciers, basically. Right next to glaciers, you have a lot of early kettle ponds, like you see in Minnesota. And the other thing is, there are a lot of plants that grow in the presence of disturbance. And a giant ice sheet's a pretty big disturbance. It tears up the landscape, something awful. So when it just retreats, it leaves a lot of these early successional plants that are plants that like to grow in these newly emerged areas. This is a lot of stuff like fireweed and willow and all sorts of stuff you find growing in ditches that moose just absolutely love. So they probably did pretty well. Now, I touched very, very, very briefly on Rudolf Peterson's refugia hypothesis. What he was trying to explain is some subspecies thing, and that gets us to the subspecies question. Now that I've given you the first little portion of the story, a biologist would go, wait, so you're saying we have subspecies? An animal that's been in North America under 10,000 years has then adapted that fast to local conditions? It certainly makes them a little skeptical. The question of subspecies is not yet settled. I'm going to talk about it a little bit. But note that what I say today could very probably change tomorrow, because this is literally a cutting-edge question about what is and isn't a subspecies. Previously, we talked about subspecies based off of physical characteristics, but we've learned that the environment can create a lot of the physical characteristics that we see. With that in mind, let's start out with Alaska and Alaskan moose subspecies. First, we have down in southeast Alaska, Alces andersoni. Alces is the moose. It literally means moose. Alces is Latin for moose. Andersoni means Anderson's moose, or the northwestern moose. It's larger than Shiras moose, which is the smallest moose, so it's bigger than the small. Well, that's not very helpful, but we'll get to that in a second. but it's smaller than the big, the tundra moose, the sort of moose that we have in and around the interior and south central Alaska. It's increasingly common. Originally, they weren't in southeast Alaska, but I'm getting ahead of myself. One of the big characteristics about them is that their breeding ecology is a little bit different from tundra moose. Now, they're what we call serial breeders. A cow, when she's entering into estrus, will sort of make some noise, let everybody around know that, hey, you know, I might be interested in mating. Bulls will then come out, sniff her out, hear her out, come on, and hang around her. If another bull comes, they'll do bull things. They'll jostle and push back and forth. Maybe he gets run off, maybe he doesn't. And eventually she'll enter receptivity and will be ready to mate. At that point, he's out. On to the next one. This is quite different from what we classically see in interior Alaska in Alces gigas, gigas meaning big. The largest moose in the world, both in body size and antler size, everything. They are what we call harem breeders, where the females tend to aggregate together in traditional rut groups. And bulls will then guard the rut groups from other bulls, and they'll have all sorts of complicated display behaviors and so forth. If you get a chance to go out and watch moose rut, it is worth doing. It's quite amazing what these animals do. And they're pretty common in Alaska. To round out the subspecies, Shiras moose is what exists in the Intermountain West. We like to call them midget moose, although they're still quite big. Shiras moose, Alces alce shirazi, if you're hip to the Latin, goes from Colorado all the way up to southern Alberta. They're more like serial breeders than not, and that's an important point. So I've talked about harem breeders and then serial breeders. You need to understand these things like harem versus serial, big versus small, antler sizes and so on. There's a lot of shades of gray, and there's a lot of room between a big rut group and a single cow. It could be a couple cows. It could be a couple cows and a couple bulls. There's a lot of wiggle room in between it, and that's where a lot of the modern science arguments are. This one is the second most rare subspecies. It's got a lot to do with American recent history, which I'll go into. And then finally, Alces americana. It is the taiga moose, or the American moose, depending on which you prefer. It's in eastern Canada and New England. It's similar to the northwestern moose in most respects. In fact, you have to be very technically adept to identify the difference between the two. And the difference primarily is in the palate. Now, the palate is that thing on the roof of your mouth that you burn pizza cheese against. I'm sure it has some other function, but I'm not sure what. And some Rudolf Peterson went through and he measured all these things, and he found that there's very distinct sets of palate sizes and palate widths. And some animals cluster together at this width, and some animals cluster together at this width. And that's how he distinguished the northwestern moose from the American moose. Now, not everyone recognizes it. For example, Boone and Crockett and Pope and Young, two big hunting clubs, do not recognize the existence of a difference between the two, because in most other respects, the moose, those two subspecies are identical, and no one's really found a good break point between the two. So, speaking of break points, in Alaska, if we got two subspecies, where does one end and the next begin? Peterson went through and he measured all his skulls and did all sorts of museum things. I don't want to demean Peterson's contribution to moose science. He produced a fantastic book and one of the first ones on moose science in the 50s that I still use to this day. But he was definitely trying to shine a flashlight in the dark, and some of the things he got wrong. And some of the things he just couldn't figure out because he didn't have skulls. He tried to get moose skulls from this area, but there weren't very many people living there. And he didn't know any of them, and he didn't get very many of them. He got a couple, and that was it. And so at the end, Rudolf Peterson just had to throw up his hands and say, well, somewhere here, we'll just kind of draw the lines together and call it good. I wanted to kind of build on some of the work that my old mentor, Chris Undermark, had done and look at a lot of these population processes, both for management purposes and also for reconstructing the moose story. And I used southeast Alaska and now interior and parts of the Yukon as sort of a natural laboratory to play a number of questions we had out on the landscape. And what I found was something pretty interesting. So these circles here correspond to genetic clusters. A genetic cluster is a group of animals who are more similar to each other than they are to another. Previously, Chris Hundertmark, with a very limited sample size, found that the Taku River down in southeast Alaska might be a major breakpoint, that he sees a change in what's called mitochondrial DNA. Now, mitochondrial DNA is important because it's only passed on from mother to daughter. Males don't pass it on. It's not like what we call nuclear DNA, which is both maternally and paternally, so both mothers and fathers give it to their offspring. I used both male and female DNA. The reason why he only used this mitochondrial DNA is because at the time he was doing it, I called it early work, it was the 90s, it wasn't that long ago, but that's the stage we were at. This is when mitochondrial DNA was easier to do. So we managed to produce a slightly more nuanced picture, and we find that a lot of the BC moose I've sampled cluster together in this sort of red cluster, and closely related to this salmon-colored cluster, and that's because they sort of exploded down this area. I'll get to that in a minute. Then we find these also cluster very firmly with the BC moose. And these orange ones are also very closely related to the red ones, but in this case, these orange moose have expanded down into the Gustavus Glacier Bay National Park and Endicott Gap area. All in all, these animals are fairly close together. It tells me that this line probably needs to be moved further north. Up here I have a different cluster, a cluster of Alces alces gigas, or what, if we say is if subspecies exist, Alces alces gigas, they would definitely be it. And we don't find any of that DNA type in and around here. Where the line between Gigas and Andersoni is, I can tell you where it isn't. I can tell you we need to keep moving it further. And this is one of the questions we're still going to work out. And even though you can genetically cluster them, doesn't mean that they're subspecies. So we still have a harder hurdle to go over. But nonetheless, it was pretty fascinating. So other things that sort of came out of this as interesting side projects, products, was a lot of nuances about how moose make their life, really. For example, we found when we knew that one population had found another, that population was founded by very few individuals. So from Haynes found the Katsuhin River population, and as few as 3.3 moose could explain all the genetic signatures we find in the Katsuhin River. Now, what's a third of a moose? Well, okay, so these are idealized hypotheticals. And I wouldn't get hung up on, you know, the decimal value and so on. The important number is it's very small. It's less than 10, it's less than 100, despite the physical proximity. And then when you look at areas that are connected by land and are a short hop, skip, and a jump, like from the Endicott River to Gustavus and Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve, these animals can get back and forth quite easily, and yet we only see low six moose could explain all the genetics. Similarly, for the Stikine River to Thomas Bay, which is an area that was previously old growth and then it was clear cut, created a lot of new moose habitat. When moose moved into it, very few moose did, despite, again, the fact this is a small distance and it's connected by land. And then, excuse me, from the Stikine River to Mitkoff Island, well, it's an island, it's right there in the name, but it's connected by a mud flat that someone could walk across that under certain low tides, and in fact, some people do. 5.2 moose could explain how many Stikine moose created the Mitkoff Island population. These are tiny numbers. So very few moose are responsible for founding it. Going back to that sort of stepping stone model we talked about, where an individual goes out, forms a population, and grows around it, and then a rare group of individuals go out from there. It's got to be very rare individuals. That's probably because very few moose go far from home. This is a complicated graph here, even for a technical expert, but what it's showing me is how moose are related at different distances from each other. And what we did is we looked at how different moose were related to each other, different cow moose, and we knew where they dropped their calves. So this distance away from this cow moose who had dropped their calf, how related to each other are they? And what we find is under a mile, these animals are very related to each other. I like to link this back probably to the process in which moose get, when a cow moose is ready to drop a calf, and she already has what we call a short yearling at heel, that is a moose that's just shy of 1 year old, you know, and hasn't yet hit his birthday. Very interesting thing happens. She gets pretty antagonistic towards that yearling and starts running it off. This yearling's pretty confused because up to this point, Mom's been their best friend in the world, and now all of a sudden she's being really hostile, and I don't know what to make of this. This is just weird. So they'll drive them a little far off, but then the yearling will just kind of stop, generally around 2 miles or maybe 3 miles, not very far. If the cow then loses her calf, the two will go and hang out, again, a technical term, hang out together again until she drops her next calf. And so it's probably through this initial pushing off process that the yearling cows are imprinting on, like, the core of their home range, maybe? That's what we think. It's probably a little more complicated than that. It has something to do with nutrition and moose density for sure. But we see this process as another moose or another deer species. And so it's not too far-fetched to think this is also happening in moose. Okay, so moose have now conquered North America, right? End of story. Well, around 1492, someone came over. I don't remember any details after that, really. Okay, so this is probably what the moose distribution at the time of European contact looked like. There's some areas where I've got a lot of question marks and some places where we've just taken a stab in the dark, but other areas we know pretty sure. For example, we know for sure there were moose in everywhere but southwest Michigan. And we know for sure that moose, albeit rare moose, were pushing as far south as Iowa. Not in Iowa, they were at the border practically. And they were in Pennsylvania and in the Intermountain West as well. That's not to say they were very abundant in all of these places, but there were at least low populations. So you see a little break here, and that seems pretty consistent with what everybody finds. It's not great moose habitat in there. The other thing you might notice is that in Alaska, there is nothing in the YK Delta. There's nothing in Nome, and there's nothing in the North Slope. So Alaska got explored pretty late. The data information isn't great. But you can look at what the early naturalists say and what the locals say and try to recreate what the picture would have been like. And what we hear from these naturalists is they didn't see many. For example, Dahl, who initially explored Alaska for the Americans and inventoried a lot of the contents of Alaska, he noted on his trip down the Yukon River that they became rare past the Koyukuk River. And then Osgood, another early American explorer in the area, recounted that when he got to the Lake Iliamna and Lake Clark areas, he didn't see many moose. More importantly, he noted that the natives say that moose are often not killed in this vicinity and were not abundant in times past. So this is elders who are saying, well, we've never really had that many moose. Finally, what is almost a smoking gun and is very convincing to me is what you see when you look at the lingo in these areas for moose. I speak Yupik, I don't speak Inupiaq or Inuktitut, so you're gonna have to forgive me on these two. But with Yupik, you have Tuntu is caribou. For moose, it's Tuntuwak, literally a big caribou. You see the same pattern in Inupiaq and Inuktitut. I'm not gonna try to figure out whether that's a V or a W. I don't speak that. But again, same pattern. These are three independent languages separated by big spatial areas. If you had a long history with moose, you generally would expect to have a unique word for moose. Now, this isn't the be-all and end-all of evidence, but what it seems to suggest to me is at some point, there was people, they had caribou, and an animal showed up and they said, what on earth is that thing? Well, it's like a big caribou. Okay, so Europeans in America, and we start recording history. What we record is that pretty much everyone who had moose was using moose in the various ways we use moose even up to today. This is an interesting painting for two reasons. First of all, is of Native Americans' traditional subsistence activities. Secondly, it's accurate to the means and methods that they were using at the time. It's a little romanticized, but most of the details are there. That's to say, most people who had access to moose enjoyed hunting them on the water. Moose are pretty diffuse on the landscape, and so if you can get around on water and try to get at the moose when they're on the water, that's a very effective means of hunting. Now, people who lived in interior areas that didn't have the best water for hunting moose, say in interior Alaska, oftentimes a strategy that was employed was to build big, long fences. And moose, being slightly lazy animals, would just kind of walk along the fence until they got to a constriction where that's where they would hunt. They'd funnel all the moose into one point. The Europeans, when they first arrived, didn't do a very good job hunting moose. Europeans had a history with moose. There are moose in Europe, despite the fact I've barely touched on them. And they had a long experience with them. They call them elk or some variation of that word. It's a Germanic root word. The problem was the ways they were used to hunting moose over there had a lot to do with access and doing drives and hunting moose in these islands of forests surrounded by vast fields of farmland. And when they got to North America, that was decidedly not what they were hunting in initially. And so they struggled. However, changes in the way they hunted came about when a lot of these, especially officers and former noblemen or rich merchants, started hiring local native guides. You see this quote, "Formerly hunting of moose appeared to our Frenchmen an impossibility, and now it seems to them as recreation." And that's from a letter from the 1600s. What happened was they started learning that you either need to hunt them on the water, well, that's not very sporting, or need to use certain sorts of hunting patterns. For example, on the eastern seaboard, they'd often hunt moose using semicircles, driving the moose further and further. So they'd come in on a semicircle, disturb the moose, stalk it further. The semicircles keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Eventually, you get in front of the animal, and you can circle on in and go for the kill. And that's a very effective means to hunt moose, especially on snowshoes. As a total side note, I love this painting down here because it has, of course, this guy aiming at the moose here. And you can't really see him that well, but there's a figure right here, and he's just standing there pointing at the moose like, yep, that's a moose. That's a moose. Are you going to pull the trigger? Please, you know, we're like 10 yards away. That you could probably hit it even with a musket. So as time went on in North America, a new form of hunting definitely took off, different, very distinct from the forms that we had before, and that's what we call market hunting. Market hunting was a major impact on North American wildlife throughout the 17, 18, and up into the early 1900s. Market hunting is exactly what it sounds like on the tin. It's hunting meat to sell at market, sometimes other products. For example, bison were hunted very heavily for their leather, which had very good industrial purposes. Moose were primarily hunted for their meat. It was fed to settlers in the Intermountain West, removing moose from some of the areas. It was fed to miners after the Yukon Gold Strike, and it was fed to all sorts of people. The other major form of hunting, commercial market hunting that went on was for their pelts. Now, the big player in this is what we call the Hudson Bay Company, or as people in the know call, the HBC. The joke in the 1800s was that HBC stood for Here Before Christ. So if you ever meet someone from the 1800s, I'm sure that's a riot. Hudson Bay Company was primarily in Canada, but they did have some Alaska presence. In particular, they founded Fort Yukon. And that's what this painting is here. It's probably romanticized just a little bit to make the Hudson Bay Company look a little better. They bought furs. They were primarily interested in furs. They also did a little side business in leather, but first and foremost, they were a fur company. And so, in that respect, moose aren't great. The thing about moose and other deer species is that their hairs tend to be a little hollow or a little foamy, and so they break off very easy. If any of you have a deer or a moose throw rug on the couch or something, you know it's constantly shedding fur. And so it's not very great for that purpose. And then when it comes to leather, well, moose have great leather, very robust leather that was used by First Nations people throughout Canada and natives in Alaska and the lower 48. Bison leather was definitely the better commercial product for HBC. That said, they did do a business in it. Moose weren't worth a lot. You could get the same price for two beaver that you could for one moose, unless it was a small moose, in which case it was only worth one. What's a small moose? I don't know. But that's what they said in their ledgers. So, yeah, it commercial hunting had it paid its toll on all North American wildlife, and moose were no exception. So I showed you the map before, and you could see these different areas have begun to peel back to certain core ranges, especially in Intermountain West. They got hit quite heavily. This is around 1875. You can see they were wiped out of Michigan, down in Pennsylvania. They weren't very, probably weren't very common there, but now they're gone. And in Alaska, there are certain areas they were probably extirpated. These market hunters were so effective that Osgood, who I mentioned before, once spent about 3 months in an area. And after those 3 months where market hunters went through and were killing animals to bring and sell to miners, he commented that he couldn't find another moose to collect for his own purposes. That's effective. They were well-oiled machines. So much so that the Hudson Bay Company and other groups became pretty worried. It started to really affect their ability to do business. That's part of the Great McKinsey Basin Report, which is this report inventorying all sorts of resources in the McKinsey Basin, as it says on the label. They were very interested in what happened to moose. And again, you can see this is only Canada at this point, because it was Canadian commercial interests. The areas that they had identified where moose were had peeled back considerably. Something had to change, and luckily, something did change. The gentleman hunter around the turn of the last century really just got tired. They wanted to go out and hunt the big trophy elk as part of their way of life, and they wanted to pass it on to their kids and their kids' kids. They wanted to be able to go out and shoot the biggest doll sheep they'd ever seen in the most natural place they'd ever been. And they saw that was going away. Already the passenger pigeon had been totally wiped off North America, is now extinct. And the bison were shot down to what they thought was extinction, was actually a couple hundred animals. They were very worried, and so people like Theodore Roosevelt in this picture, they looked at it and said, we need a new conservation ethic. This was fed into by people like Muir here, who brought in the conservation end, not from any sort of desire to maintain the gentleman hunter class, but conservation for conservation's sake. And they joined forces and produced a lot of the early wildlife law in what we call now the North American model. The North American model has been a fantastic success. It is where hunters pay for the conservation of that which they hunt through taxes, through license fees, through all sorts of stuff. And it's probably the reason why North America has far more wildlife than Europe or other comparable areas, because we've taken conservation very seriously, thanks to people like Muir, like Roosevelt, and these other early conservationists around the 1900s. The fact that at the same time we entered a new romantic period didn't really hurt. This romantic period didn't always necessarily get things right. Sometimes people just got so passionate about nature, even if they'd never seen it. In this painting, I presume we have a pack of foxes? Or no, no. Corgis. These are corgis. See the legs? They seem to be hunting either some sort of bison or cattle with deformed elk antlers. So I'm sure this artist watched the scene himself. In addition to the romantic movement towards nature around the 1900s, it also was the beginning of an era of spectacle. It was for good and for ill. This is an unfortunate side product of what was Alaska's more or less Wild West days. This is in Skagway, and this poor beast was not from Southeast Alaska or BC as I initially thought, but it was actually from the Yukon. They took it from Dawson City and brought it on down to entertain miners for a fee, of course. Now, this poor animal's existence is indicative of all the other times that people have tried to domesticate moose so far, and poorly for everyone involved. This poor animal died after 2 years, I think, of what I read. The owner attributed it to eating too much clover, which to me says either trace mineral deficiencies or it had gut bloat. No one really got out ahead of it. Moose are wild animals, and these spectacles certainly never really ended the way people wanted them to. Certainly, efforts to domesticate moose never really turned out great either. I hear in Russia they're trying to milk moose, and I'm sure this time it's going to totally work out. Unlike the previous several hundred times, it went horribly wrong. So, humans weren't the only thing changing. Moose were also changing. As industrial industrialization overtook North America, it reached our forestry practices, and British Columbia began very intensively logging and selling their timber to America and other places through a process we call clear cutting, which sounds like it is on the tin. You cut everything clear down to the ground and you ship it off for sale. This is initially very good for moose because, as I said, moose like this disturbance. They eat this early growing in plants. This allowed moose to start going from this part of their range where they'd previously been restricted, start infiltrating the rest of British Columbia. You can't really read this here. It says, no one available to make report. That's very dismissive of all the loggers and all the miners who were up there. But unfortunately, literacy wasn't very high up there, and people who were interested in writing down what they saw wasn't very high up there. So we don't really know what was going on in the portion of BC that was connected to Alaska, but we have a much better idea of what was going on in southeast Alaska, which was not very far behind them. So the nearest we could figure in northern BC, they were probably there around 1900. After that, they snaked on down the Taku and the Stikine River around 1910, plus or minus something. We're not too sure on these dates. We know they also showed up fairly early around Haines and the Katsihin River. We know this because they were soon eaten. A individual saw a very strange creature he had never seen before swimming across from Haines to the Katsihin River. Said, oh, that's weird. Went over to it in a boat, said, oh, that's really weird. I should eat it. Killed it, ate it, decided, that's weird, but it was delicious. I went and reported this to another person who was in the area who was literate and wrote it down. And so the person knew what it was. Said, you just killed the only moose we've ever seen in this country. Moose came in the 1920s, 1924, and we're pretty sure on that date, because again, from diaries and lots of recorded information. After that, you know, they made it down into the Malaspina forelands around Yakutat, same period. Then it took a little while to snake around the coasts, make their way into like Gustavus, the Glacier Bay area, the Endicott Gap, St. George Bay. Thomas Bay, they got into pretty fast because it was connected. I say pretty fast, that's 30 to 40 years. They got there because, again, we were in the mode of industrial timber harvesting, clear-cutting broad swaths of forests, and the moose moved in and went like gangbusters. Mitkoff and Kuprinoff Island, though, were much later in the 1980s. So there's been a lot of change in where moose were even within our lifespan. There's two points I hadn't talked about. This one and this one. They have asterisks next to them. And that's because we gave the moose a helping hand. So the first transplant that we're aware of that people had a place in was in the Copper River Basin. Not to say people didn't move moose on the sly before then, but we just don't know about it. They figured that moose would never arrive to the Copper River Delta naturally, and that's probably true, although we don't know that for 100%. And so they wanted to create a huntable population there. There was plenty of food for the moose, just no moose. So well-meaning citizens began rounding them up from the Anchorage, Matsu, and Kenai. A lot of these animals were supposedly orphan calves. The numbers of orphan calves seems a little dubious. So it might have been, in some places, a case of good intentions run amok. And certainly people were trying to figure out things as they went. They were very well intentioned, but keeping moose has never been really successful. In particular, their calf mortality was really high, both in trying to keep them and trying to put them out in the landscape. Just to emphasize just how much information they were trying to learn about how to keep moose. At one point, someone wrote the Purina Animal Chow Company saying, which one of your feeds would you feed to a moose? The Purina Animal Chow Company gave some response. I forget what it was, but it wasn't very helpful. Something to the effect of, we feed dogs. However, things got better. Over the years, we figured out how to move them, and the Copper River transplant was very successful. There are moose there to this day. We took a lot of the lessons, and the Territorial Sportsman Club down in Juneau decided they wanted a huntable population of moose down there too. So again, moose from Anchorage, Matsu, Kenai were moved down to Juneau, where they were released in the Berners Bay area, which is just north of Juneau, around Echo Cove, if you know the area. Things went a lot smoother, but like everything in Alaska, there's always hiccups. For example, the first time they released them, everything went according to plan. That was in 1956. In 1958, I like to think of that as the day Southeast Alaskans forgot how to read tide books. They got to the bay, and they ran into mud. Well, we're not going anywhere on this mudflat. Well, off the moose went. And the moose mostly made it to shore. And those who didn't were given a helping hand. But definitely a learning process. And I could tell you, doing field work today, not a heck of a lot different. We're always learning about new little catches. Working in Alaska is hard. We're not the only ones to return moose to their to different places or introduce them to other ones. I'm not going to talk about Newfoundland, but Newfoundland is an introduced population of moose. And Colorado is also bringing their moose back. They decided in 1978 to start bringing these moose that were extirpated, were totally removed from the landscape, back into the area. And starting in 1978 with partners like the Forest Service, BLM, the National Park Service, Utah Department of Natural Resources, which provided some of the moose, and then the state of Wyoming, who also provided some moose, and managed to have a very successful program. Since then, they've had four more releases. The most recent one was in the last 10 years, and they have a strong, vibrant, huntable population, which shows that hunting and conservation dollars through hunting can really help bring animals back to the landscape. Similarly, moose have been changing on their own. So out in the Arctic coast, we'd said there hadn't been a lot of moose. However, during the 1940s, people noticed that the moose on the North Slope really started to take hold. This is coincident with a couple of other observations people have generally noted, like shrubs, which had been rare on the landscape, began expanding, and the data green up kept moving earlier and earlier. Talking to Geoff Carroll, who was the former area biologist for 20-something years, possibly even 30, I don't remember. I know it's over 20. He had told me that he suspected that fall snow was becoming more and more rare throughout the course of his career. And he noticed it because it impacted his ability to do surveys. Now, despite the fact that things are becoming more and more moosey and moose habitat-like on the North Slope and in northwest Alaska, there's a little complication in that after decades of steady growth, the population has declined. We have no idea why. We're still working on that. We're very curious. But all indications are that the area is becoming better and better habitat. Alaska in general is changing. From glacier retreat down in the south, this is Plateau Glacier, a photograph of the same place, 40 years later. You could see massive changes and tons of moose food. Not so much moose food. However, that doesn't last forever. After the glaciers recede, they go through these early successional stages, but eventually it turns into temperate coastal rainforest. Similarly, after clear cuts, you get all this initial food, but then sitka spruce begin coming back. And how moose will persist in this changing landscape is still honestly a bit of an open question. Similarly, here's this Arctic greening I was talking about. You can see it's a photograph of the same place at the same time of year. Shrubs on the valley bottom that didn't used to be, and a lot of shrubs expanding on the side of the slope. Alaska is changing. And Alaska is becoming a lot more urban. Anchorage has gone from a sleepy little town to what's properly a big city in the Mat-Su Valley. I mean, it's doubled in size within all of our memories. Things are changing fast. And how humans and moose can live together, that's not an entirely settled question. In general, it seems like moose have been doing pretty good in the Anchorage area. But there's early indications that maybe they might need a helping hand in a few places. For example, recent work by Sean Farley with Fish and Game down in Anchorage, and then Rob Wilson with the USGS found that the Glenn Highway seems to be creating such an impediment to moose moving back and forth between J-Bear Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and the rest of Anchorage that they're becoming two separate populations. We're still early in this process, and so we'll be interested to see how it plays out and what we can do to make this go away through habitat manipulation or maybe jiggering our infrastructure just right so they can get across the road. But we don't know what that means. The future of moose is a really open question, but moose are animals that are fundamentally connected with change, either climate change from the ice age or changing river conditions as the ice scours things out and creates new willows, or changes from timber practices. So I have no doubt, as we see more change, moose will be riding this change along with it. But only time will tell how things will play out. And with that, I want to thank you guys for your time. Here's what it's about, watching a moose walking on by me, grunting all the while. Just a gorgeous animal. So thank you so much for your time. And I apologize for this cold I'm fighting here. It's been...
No worries.
That was a great lecture.
Now, do we have the largest species right here in the Matsu?
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, would you mind repeating the question?
Yep, absolutely. So the largest subspecies, do we have the largest subspecies here in the Matsu? That is correct. What we have in the Matsu, if we have anything at all, and moose subspecies exist, this is Alces gigas. In fact, one of the largest moose, I believe, was it shot in 16 or 17? I can't remember which. Either in the Dillingham area or in Unit 16. Either way, we're known for having very large moose. Biggest one I've seen? Probably this guy, actually. He is huge. He is well over 72 inches. And he didn't care I was there. We were out watching moose, and this guy came up from behind me. And I had a German with me, Heiko Wittemer. He's a fellow researcher. And we were bringing students out to watch moose rut. Heiko, this is out in Denali National Park. And Heiko goes, not to concern anyone, in his very German sort of way, but stand up and turn around. And this guy was just looking at us going, well, I want to be over there with the cows you were watching. But you're in my way. But I don't want to go around. I got to think about this for a while. And he walked on by. He gave us such a show. It was pretty amazing.
So when moose came over from Beringia, mm-hmm. Beringia sort of close behind them, caribou had been here considerably longer, right?
Oh, yeah.
Caribou were well established. It seems difficult to imagine how moose could have competed with caribou in that sort of paleo environment. So how moose managed to survive in competition with caribou in the early period in North America?
Well, the truth is there's not much competition between moose and caribou. They tend to have fairly separate diets. Or so the cartoon story goes. Caribou eat a lot of lichens and forbs, which are kind of grassy plants, if you want to think about them that way. Not exactly grasses. That's more of a bison thing. But if you think about something that's really green and soft, that's a forb. Whereas moose are very selective browsers. And browser means they go around and they eat woody stuff. And they're selective. You can tell this because their lips are huge. They use their lips to pick and choose individual bites. I'm not repeating my question. So the question was, would there be competition between caribou and moose in the paleo environment? How did moose get in there? So moose are picking and choosing these woody plants, trying to high grade for the most nutritional stuff, whereas caribou are just walking around on the landscape, feeding on lichens and forbs and in big aggregates. Oh, just stretching.
So on the Glen Highway issue, as far as the potentially two populations developing, are you attributing that completely to the fact that the fencing was done along there to try and help the moose from being hit on the Glen? Or?
The question was whether or not we're attributing the population divide between Jay Bear and Anchorage to the fencing. And I personally don't know. This is new science to everyone. We've just learned this in the last calendar year. And so we're still exploring how this works. I believe the Anchorage office has a couple of GPS-collared moose, and they're looking at how they move across the landscape. And they're hoping to learn what is the factors that are leading to this. But beyond that, this is so new that I just don't know enough to have a really qualified opinion yet.
If I could follow up on that. How many crossing points were there created in that project?
The question was how many crossing points were created in the fencing project. I don't know. I work in Region 4, which does not include Anchorage, and I don't know a lot about Jay Bear. And before this, I lived in Fairbanks at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And once you live in Fairbanks, everything south of the Alaska Range is, well, it's not really Alaska, no, is it? I'm joking. This has been a lovely place.
I noticed a lot of red collars, the big wide collars in the picture. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of moose, haven't ever seen a single one of those collars. Are they common in a certain area, or am I just missing it?
The question was about the collars that were showing up in some of the photos that were big red collars. So what you actually see in that photo is what we call a vis collar. The actual collar is a tiny little narrow band, well, relative to the size of a moose, underneath that. That's a thing that's basically just a piece of fabric we kind of bolt onto the top on some projects so we can see them better. A lot of those photos with those big red collars were from the rainforest, from the temperate rainforest, where I think rainforests have a few trees, is the saying. So it's hard to see the forest for the trees. It's hard to see the moose for the forest. And we've put on those visual collars in those projects because we need high sightability for different things. One thing I want to just throw out there, and something people often ask me about when I was working on those Southeast Alaska moose, is they seem awfully gaudy. Well, you got to remember, we see differently than most animals. Most of those colors were reds and oranges, which to their predators look at like greens and browns. So we try to choose colors that bears and wolves can't really see. The question was about the different breeding strategies of the different subspecies of moose and whether or not maybe the physical geography of where these moose are could have some role in it. And she brought up an example of where she'd seen down in the lowlands a bull, just a single bull on a cow, while there was a harem up the hill. And I could tell you, they probably weren't ready to do the horizontal because you spooked them. And so when they are pretty ready to do it, they've got exactly one thing on the brain, and it's pretty hard to distract them from it. they're pretty single-minded creatures when it comes to the rut, both bulls and cows. I can't help myself. I'll get back to your question in a moment. If you go and watch these rut groups, oftentimes you'll see male scent mark into these muddy, what we call wallows. They're big muddy pits, and they have this very pungent odor associated with them. The cows are so fiercely competitive over getting into that wallow. They'll push the bull on out, and then they want to be in there and have the time of their life, and then the cows will start pushing and shoving at each other. Yeah, humans can smell it, and different people have different words to describe it. I think it's just distinct. what my former mentor, Chris Undermark, would call it, he said it stinks. Other people think it smells musky in a pleasant way. So individual differences. Okay, so back to breeding, back to your actual question. Sorry, I just couldn't help myself. Probably, like I said, these breeding systems are a bit of a cartoon picture. And there's a lot of plasticity that is like wiggle room between that one point and the other. You're telling me if a harem breeding moose sees a single cow hanging out in that itself, and he can't get into that harem and take it over himself, he's not going to hang out with that receptive cow? That seems pretty absurd to me because, again, moose only have one thing on the mind around then. That said, those are the generalities that we see. And so how much it is one way or the other seems to have to do with the subspecies, or at least that's the current state of our knowledge.
So mostly in Pat Sue, we have harem breeders.
She asked if mostly in the Mat Sue we have harem breeders, and that's probably the case. Mostly in the Mat Sue it is harem breeders. Again, not to say that if a bull who can't move in and displace some other harem-guarding bull sees a receptive cow off on her own, he's not going to go hang out with her for a while.
We have time for one or two more questions, and then we should wrap up.
totally different kind of question. I work at the recycling center, and we have recently been made aware of the challenges of plastic bags hanging in trees and that sort of thing, being ingested by caribou and reindeer, apparently at the reindeer farm out in the valley. They had, about 5 years ago, they had lots of unexplained deaths, and they finally did a necropsy and determined that they were eating plastic. And so at that point, they changed the role of every worker there. The first thing they do when they come on shift is to go scour the pasture area and make sure that there's no candy wrappers and no plastic and that sort of thing. And they've not had a single reindeer die, I understand, in the last 5 years. So that's circumstantial, but it sounds reasonable. And we've had now several other folks come forward with information about caribou also eating. We haven't heard anything about moose eating plastic. And I'm wondering if you have heard or if there's any studies going on about this, because it's a problem with dogs and cats and parakeets and all kinds of animals.
So the question was about ruminants like caribou eating plastic and it turning out to be a big thing, and whether or not it's a significant factor for moose health as well. And to be quite frank, I don't know the answer to the question. What I can tell you is that certain smaller plastic things can pass quite successfully through a moose digestive system. And I know this because we've used small plastic things to figure out how long different things take to move through the moose digestive system. Now, I'm not telling you to go out and feed a moose a Snickers wrapper, but under very scientific controlled circumstances, smaller pieces of plastic can be used. That said, most of the plastics we're concerned about are things like shopping bags or like large wrappers, packaging. And I have not heard about that before, and it'd be really interesting to find out. One last question. Nothing?
With the cereal breeders, does that affect how the diversity changes over parent breeders?
The question was whether cereal breeders have, it changes how diversity changes versus the heron breeders. I didn't phrase that question very well, but I understand your question. It is actually an excellent question. And the answer is probably yes. When you have only one or a very small number of males passing on their DNA to a large group, including individuals that they're probably related to, not as much DNA is passed on to the next generation. Whereas when you have more breeding males, more DNA is passed on to the next generation, and you have slightly less chance of inbreeding in the population as well. But again, it's a really messy story, and the devil is in the details, but that's an excellent question. Well, thanks everyone for your time. I really appreciate talking about moose to an audience.